I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. In the first season of Buried Truths, I said that the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project at Emory and this podcast are not about whodunit, because in almost every case, we know who did it, and they're all dead. But not in the A.C. Hall case. Both police officers who shot A.C. Hall were alive and easy to locate when the Justice Department reopened the case in 2007. All of our research suggests that the Justice Department in 2011 ignored discrepancies in the accounts of key players, whose stories sharply contradicted their testimony from 1962. So much so, we were surprised that federal investigators walked away from the case. Their report in 2011 said there is insufficient evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that either Brown or Durden acted with the requisite criminal intent. According to Brown, the subjects fired when the victim turned toward them and pulled a gun. Well, as we know, A.C. Hall didn't have a gun. The Justice Department's report says nothing about this contradiction. It just says that Brown's story in 2011 was consistent with what he said in 1962, and therefore was credible. Now, I told you that the Department of Justice reopened a lot of civil rights cold cases in early 2007. Upon conclusion of their investigations, they proceeded to close almost all of them. Then they sent letters, closing memos they called them, to survivors of the victims, explaining why they were closing the case. So it was in the Department of Justice's letter in the A.C. Hall case that we detected the discrepancies in statements by Officer Brown and the Hoppers. So I called the Justice Department attorneys, asking them to explain how they could have missed these contradictions. I received an email response from, you'll have to bear with me on this title, the Deputy Chief of the Cold Case Unit and Senior Legal Counsel of the Criminal Section of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. She invited me to point out our findings and added, "I will examine any and all information you provide to assess whether it is sufficient to warrant reopening the matter or issuing an amended closing memo." So, Buried Truth subscribers, stay tuned. When I know their response, I'll let you know. I've told you a great deal about the later life of Eloise Franklin, who called A.C. Hall her first love. I told you that she bore a son and gave the baby to A.C. Hall's mother to raise. But what of the other key players in this tragedy? Well, let's go through some of them. Police Officer James Larry Durden.
And I put my pistol out the window and fired.
Larry Durden was allowed to rejoin the police force in 1962, but chose not to stay. Durden's son, Kenny, told me that his father gave up on police work after the A.C. Hall shooting. He was a police officer for less than 9 months.
Well, he resigned when that happened. Then that's when we moved and got away from where we lived and all.
Larry Durden went into the commercial excavation business, and he died in 2009. So what became of police officer Josh Brown?
I was shooting to the left side, just pulling the trigger fast as I could pull it.
Like Durden, Brown was allowed to return to the Macon Police Department after the grand jury. Unlike Durden, Brown stayed on the force for decades. You know, I really wished we'd gotten a response from his family when we called them, but we didn't. So Brown retired in 1991 after 29 years on the Macon Police Force. And then he died in 2016 at the age of 87. Witnesses Doris and Barnett Hopper.
We would rather just let it stay back in the city where it was.
In our brief phone conversation in 2019, Doris told me she didn't want to subject herself or her husband to an interview.
I don't want to talk about it because, honestly, I don't want to talk about it. I don't think I should have to. It's been closed out and settled, and I don't see the point of bringing it up again.
But the FBI did bring it up again in 2011 and then came to the same conclusion. Then there's Prosecutor Jack Gautier.
Did you or did you not at any time see a revolver or weapon on A.C. Hall?
Gautier, the assistant solicitor at the inquest, went on to become the top solicitor. I visited with his daughter, Alice Gautier Fincher, in her Macon home.
I mean, he wasn't a massive person. He was 5'11 and thin.
She described her dad as a bright and honest man who could be quite intimidating when he wanted to be. His targets? Well, first of all, the boys who came to date her when she was a teenager. But you can imagine that he turned his glare on criminal defendants and defense attorneys.
I think he did scare people, you know, somewhat. You know how some people just have a manner. And we didn't cross him. I can say that.
Fincher said her father never lost an election, but he was troubled. Troubled by poor health and alcoholism, which was not a secret. While still in office in May 1972, Gautier walked into the evidence vault at the courthouse and shot himself. Next, defense attorney Denmark Groover.
Were you standing on one foot, or was he holding you all the way off the ground?
Now, I told you earlier that as a state legislator, Groover sponsored the bill in 1956 to add the Confederate battle emblem to the Georgia state flag. Decades later, Groover conceded that changing the flag was not about honoring Confederate heritage or supporting states' rights. It was a gesture of white Southern defiance. And it flew over the state capital of Georgia, indicating the state's refusal to let black children go to school with white children. That was quite an admission by him. And in 2001, at age 78, a penitent Groover returned to the Georgia House and made a remarkable speech. A new flag without the Confederate battle emblem would, in his words, bring to an end this cauldron of discord that adversely affects our lives and the future of our children and grandchildren. Groover died about 3 months after making that speech. That brings us to civil rights attorney Donald Lee Hollowell.
As a matter of fact, now, your identification is based only on the fact that the man had on pants, had on a shirt, white shirt, with the shirt tail out.
Hollowell, the Mr. Civil Rights attorney who represented Curly Hall, AC's mother, at the inquest, continued his groundbreaking legal work for many years afterward. Among other things, he led a voter registration project that nearly doubled the number of black voters in the country. It was Hallowell who in 1961 had sued to force the University of Georgia to admit the first black students to the state's flagship school. More than 50 years later, that same school, UGA, created the Hallowell Professorship of Social Justice and Civil Rights Studies. Hallowell died in 2004 at the age of 87. And finally, we come to civil rights attorney Howard Moore, Jr.
And would it be a fair statement to say that he was shot in the back?
Moore was the young attorney who helped represent Curley Hall. You know, I'm so happy that my students and I got to spend time with Howard Moore because he told just some amazing stories. And I'd like to crack the door on some Southern history involving Howard Moore in one of Georgia's more absurd historical episodes. Georgia officials resisted virtually every federal desegregation and racial equality mandate that came their way. So in 1966, Julian Bond, a black activist who was a leader in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, was elected to the Georgia House of Representatives. Well, the white fellows in the House, they didn't care for having a black man sitting in the chamber. But they knew they couldn't refuse to seat him just for being black. Then Julian Bond spoke out against U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War, and they pounced. They decided that his resistance to federal policy in Vietnam was nothing short of treason, and they tried to oust him for this unpatriotic behavior. Well, Howard Moore, who was married to Bond's sister, Jane, took the case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which saw through the legislature's hypocrisy and gave Julian Bond back his seat. In an even higher profile case, held during a politically overheated period, Howard Moore, in 1972, defended Angela Davis, college professor, Black Panther, communist, against charges connected to a shootout in a California courthouse. Moore headed the defense team that won an acquittal for Davis. Now, I want to tell you one more story about Howard Moore, something I witnessed. He was 86, and he'd been a fierce and brilliant defender of unpopular causes ever since Donald Hallowell handed him that Georgia law book and told him to get smart about coroner's inquests and head to Macon. Now, I told you that when he entered the Macon courthouse in October 1962, everyone walking around him, the judges with the black robes, the deputies with the badges and the guns, the court reporters, the jurors, the other lawyers, all of them were white. All the people of color were either in the balcony or in the jail on the top floor or being shuffled around in handcuffs to stand trial. So when Moore and I returned to that same courthouse nearly 60 years later, the visual evidence of change was all around. Black deputies, black jurors, black lawyers, even a black judge here and there. As we climbed the stairs to the second floor, we were met by a smiling Erica Woodford, a black woman, the clerk of the Macon Bibb Superior Court. She was first elected in 2012 with 55% of the vote, and then she won again 4 years later, unopposed. Now, she'd been a great help to me and my students over the years as we searched for documents.
See, that's 61.
Inside the old courthouse, she'd once led me on an expedition. She joined me in climbing steep, narrow, and noisy steps onto a catwalk through rooms packed with historic records and into a poorly lighted vault, a catacomb where old court files.
It looks like an old ammo box without the sides, doesn't it? You know?
Land ledgers.
Well, after and before.
Slave trade documents are stored that led to the original copy of the coroner's inquest.
Certainly hasn't. Oh, wait a second. Here it is.
Is that it?
There it is. Look. It's listed in 61.
Are you kidding?
No. Filed in this office.
A few weeks later, we returned to the Bibb County Courthouse with Howard Moore.
All right, thank you so much. So nice.
She was thrilled to present me with some very good news. With the help of a longtime bailiff, she'd found out which courtroom held the A.C. Hall inquest 56 years earlier. And she'd cleared or moved the courtroom schedule so I'd have full use of it for a couple of hours. Now, I could see her looking with great anticipation at meeting the tall, bearded, distinguished gentleman in front of her, Howard Moore. His reputation had preceded him, and she was, well, I'd say she was bubbling at the opportunity to meet him. We had just ascended the marble steps inside the courthouse, and Howard's lanky frame was pitched a little forward, his face looking down. "Howard," I said, "I want you to meet Erica Woodford." Okay. Now, Howard can be inscrutable at times, hard to read. He raised his head. He looked at her. His eyes warmed. His face relaxed. Looking at Erica Woodford, Howard Moore was seeing more than a black elected official and more than a clerk of the Superior Court. He was seeing the embodiment of something very important to him.
Hey, this is what we were working for in the 60s, all right?
Yes, sir.
So these are dreams coming true. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
All right.
Throughout this season of Buried Truths, we've been mindful that this shooting was not an incident isolated in the distant past. Ever since 1962 and right up to this moment, young black men like A.C. Hall have been shot and killed by the police again and again. Now, you've probably heard about the killings of Philando Castile, Alton Sterling, and Tamir Rice. But here's some cases that, like A.C. Hall's, you may not be familiar with.
The death of 22-year-old Stephon Clark. Clark was killed carrying his cell phone in his grandparents' backyard.
Not guilty verdict for former East Pittsburgh police officer Michael Rosfeld, charged with homicide in the shooting death of Antoine Rose II. Rose, unarmed, was fleeing.
Ariston Waiters. He said he was trying to handcuff Waiters when the teen reached for his gun. That's when Lewis said he shot Waiters twice in the back.
As was the case with A.C. Hall, the police officers in these shootings were never charged with any crime. But these young men weren't killed some 50 or 60 years ago. All of these shootings occurred after 2010. We do have examples of police being charged and convicted in similar shootings. And, of course, many police shootings are completely justified. The officer really was in mortal danger and had no choice. But in questionable cases, why do some police officers go to prison while others walk away free? It's not because of better investigating techniques. It's not a sudden willingness by police to go all out when an officer kills a civilian. A huge part of the answer? Video. The officer who fired those shots, killing Walter Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina, is in prison. A bystander taped the killing, and the entire world saw a murder unfold on YouTube. The officer who fired 16 shots into Laquan McDonald in Chicago, he's also in prison, convicted largely by a police dash cam. In suburban Atlanta, a white police officer is to stand trial in September 2019 for shooting a naked, unarmed black man, an Air Force veteran named Anthony Hill. There's no video in that case, but there's this. The officer lied at the scene about why he found it necessary to shoot. He told the next officer at the scene that Hill pounded on him with his fists. Later, however, the officer admitted that Hill never actually touched him. As the Laquan McDonald and Walter Scott cases show, it's just possible that if you present a jury with clear and convincing evidence, you'll get a guilty verdict. Perhaps the arc of the moral universe really does bend toward justice. What if 60 years ago, district attorneys had aggressively prosecuted cases like the A.C. Hall killing? What if, way back then, the states had declared that the death of any person at the hands of police, any person, would trigger a special investigation by an outside agency? If we had set the bar that high all those years ago, would the country still be having 1,000 police killings a year? Would a disproportionate number of black citizens be shot and killed by police? Why did so many people behave this way back in the 1960s? And when I think about it, why does this attitude still linger with some people today? Why did we so blindly accept or succumb to the beliefs that our white supremacist forebears built into our education, our society, our understanding, and what I've called in this podcast, our racial conditioning? And why, when we could have rejected the myths and the lies, didn't we? Why were there not more people willing to think independently, stand against the mob mentality, and do what those five white jurors in the coroner's inquest did? Examine the evidence critically, seek the God's honest truth, resist the pressure to conform, and reach a verdict. I can't help but think of a story that Gene Patterson once told from his days as editor of the Atlanta Constitution in the 1960s. Gene Patterson wrote a column every single day. His voice was clear and progressive as he encouraged white Southerners to reject the mindless, reactionary, race-baiting leaders who divided people and communities. And one day, a reader of his, a man who didn't really care for Patterson's viewpoint, came up to him. "I know what you're doing, Mr. Patterson," the man said. "You're trying to make us think that we're better than we are." Change comes slowly to the Peach State, but it does come, most of the time. Remember how I told you about the extraordinary privilege that police enjoyed when it came to grand juries and inquests? They could attend the hearing, listen to everything, then give an unsworn statement at the end that couldn't be challenged. The state law that allowed this stayed on the books in Georgia until 2016. You heard me right, 2016. By then, Georgia was the only state in the union that offered such protections to police officers. Well, guess what? That law finally changed. And here's why. After the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014, reporters at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution tried to find out how often police killed civilians in Georgia. What happened to the officers afterwards? Well, you might want to pull up a chair and have a seat for this one. The paper's findings? More than 170 people were killed by police between 2010 and 2015 in Georgia. And how many indictments were there? One. Just one. Oh, and it was thrown out the next day. And of those 170 people killed by police between 2010 and 2015, how many went to trial? Go ahead, just come up with a number. Take a wild guess. Out of 170, zero.
The criminal justice system in Georgia found every single fatal police shootings over that period perfectly legal.
That's Brad Schrade, the lead reporter on the Atlanta newspaper's investigation. Another thing the team discovered, nearly half the civilians who were killed were either unarmed or shot in the back, just like A.C. Hall. Ordinarily, they're eager to prosecute a shooting death, but that tends to change when a cop is the shooter. and two-thirds of the cases, prosecutors, who were so dependent on police for most of their cases, didn't even take the case to the grand jury. And when a prosecutor did present a shooting case to the grand jury, the officer got to sit in.
It was a very powerful tool to be in the grand jury room. You go to bathroom breaks, you run into grand jurors, you become humanized. And the officers would give statements, they would cry, they would, you know, talk about their years of dedicated public service.
Schrade went deep on several of the cases. He recalls one in Griffin, Georgia. The person who was shot was on the ground, face down.
Walter Folds, his life had sort of come apart. He had been in a domestic situation with his wife, and they were going to meet in a park to talk or what have you, and the police intervened, and there was a chase. Folds took off running. There was a struggle. Folds apparently brought out a some kind of blade or cutter. He kind of nicked one of the police officers. The police had him pinned down on the ground. One of the officers had put his gun in the holster and was getting out a taser to restrain him. And the other officer shot Folds in the back of the head.
This was the one police shooting during those 5 years that resulted in an indictment against the police officer. One out of more than 170 cases.
The very next day, the prosecutor took the case to a judge and had it thrown out and said he didn't feel like there was probable cause or he didn't feel like there was enough evidence to get a conviction. The officer in that case, he spoke in the grand jury. The grand juror we interviewed for that case, you know, she lost sleep over the case. It was, you know, deeply troubling. It was an African-American man, a white officer. The family of Folds did not even know what had happened in the case till we showed up and explained it to them.
It wasn't unusual for the family to feel that it was in the dark. That's an echo from the past, and it continues today. Back then, in just about any investigation into white violence against a black person, white prosecutors, federal or state, simply didn't drop by the homes of black people to update them on the status of their work. If they didn't prosecute, they didn't call a press conference to say why. They just didn't prosecute. So after Schrade and his team published their findings, the legislature took action. The Prosecuting Attorneys Council of Georgia proposed a bill that would strip officers of their special privileges. The Georgia Sheriff's Association fought the measure, saying officers need it and deserve these protections. The result? A compromise.
Officers in Georgia are no longer allowed to be in the grand jury room the entire time. If they give a statement, they can face cross-examination.
Are they sworn in?
I believe they are sworn in now, yes. There is a transcript of these grand jury proceedings. That has changed the dynamic somewhat. They can still give that statement, but they are subject to some of the same rules that any other witness in the grand jury would have.
As a longtime journalist, I have to tell you, I love it when good journalism leads to important changes in the law. And this is a good one for the press, but more importantly, for the people.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org. Support for WABE comes from 100 Miles, a nonprofit committed to preserving Georgia's 100-mile coast. Protecting this critical coastal ecosystem takes all of us. Watch the stories of the innovators and future leaders who help keep our coast flowing at OurGeorgiaCoast.org.
I'm a journalist, sort of a historian, and an author, but I'm also a teacher. I've been directing the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project at Emory University for 8 years, and I've had some terrific students. Three of the semesters, since 2011, I've examined the A.C. Hall case, and this past semester I got some terrific papers from the students. In fact, so much of what you've heard in this podcast came from the ideas and the research by students. The stories you've heard about police privilege, about how police departments were formed from slave patrols, about the problems of cross-racial identification, the profiles you've heard of some of the players, the role of black mothers in the South as told through the prism of Curly Hall, and certainly how Southerners were racially conditioned has been a topic of student interest. In the fall of 2018, I suggested to my students that we might want to take a trip down to Macon on Saturday, October 13th, which would be the 56th anniversary of A.C. Hall's death. And every one of them signed up. We gathered at the Middle Georgia Veterans Club as night was falling. Then, at about the same time that A.C. and Eloise set out on foot in 1962, we started walking the same path that they had walked. Newt Collier, A.C.'s childhood friend, joined us. Actually, he led us. We reached the site of the former George Washington Carver School, which is now a county detention center. We then walked to the field behind the school where A.C. had run and where the police had fired their guns. We stayed there in the dark for close to an hour, talking quietly, sharing thoughts, reflecting. This is from an exchange that night between two students, Kira Baldwin and Aaron Okindo, on the role of fate in A.C.'s death.
What if Mr. Hopper had come home, or Mrs. Hopper had come home just a little later, and they had called the police like 10 minutes later?
It's wild to think, though, that we have more information about his death than he ever did.
Yeah.
The next day, we visited the cemetery where A.C. is buried. The six letters of his name are carved into a small block of stone on a grave right next to his mother's. Kira Baldwin was still thinking about something that had not hit me before she said it, that A.C. Hall, when the police are shooting at him, has no clue why any of this is happening.
I wonder if he felt like his death was almost arbitrary, like A.C. was so innocent and young, and it's just really sad.
This is Cecilia Bay, who said she had come to view A.C. Hall as a three-dimensional person, not just a name in a study guide or a term paper.
I wonder what it would have been like to grow up in that time, to have been an African-American man or woman during that period, and how constantly anxious and afraid he must have felt, and how confused and shocked and angry and in pain and everything that he must have felt in his final moments.
When we arrived at the cemetery in Macon, the students found grave sites that were covered with dried grass clippings, stringy weeds, leaves. My previous visits to the cemetery had taught me to bring pruning shears and clippers to clean up the last resting place of A.C. Hall, his mother Curly Hall, and his grandparents, Johnny and Early Kinder. Another of my students, Shayla Vasquez, was surprised at her response to the Macon visit.
So today, this morning, we went to the grave of A.C. Hall, and surprisingly, I actually did feel pretty emotional about it. Didn't think I would, just because everything in my newsfeed and every day is just seeing black boys die by the hands of cops. So why would this one make a difference? I'm not sure why, but cleaning off his grave as if in some way I was taking care of him really affected me emotionally.
Well, you know, she's got a point. I mean, many of my students here at the gravesite were about 7 years old when New York Police Department officers fired 50 times into the car of Sean Bell on the night before his wedding. They were 13 when Black Lives Matter formed, and about 15 when Michael Brown was shot in Ferguson, Missouri. They grew up on a steady diet of stories about black men being shot and white police officers going free. Student Presley West spoke powerful words in her soft voice.
And just coming here and knowing how much we know about IC and how little other people know has made me realize how many untold stories are buried in cemeteries like this all around the country. And it's just crazy to think that there could be AC halls everywhere that we've never even heard of.
Newton Collier, AC Hall's childhood friend from Macon, had accompanied us to the cemetery.
Your Lord, on this Sunday,
he offered a brief prayer.
To represent and be the new family of AC Hall. Amen.
Did you hear what Newt Collier said? The new family of A.C. Hall. Good Lord, I love that. From the day we started on this A.C. Hall story, I've been struck by how alone A.C. Hall is in our world today. Maybe not where he is, but where we are now. Do you remember in an earlier episode that I thought about A.C. heading off to school one morning, the day of school pictures? I had in my head a scene in which Curly Hall makes sure his jeans are starched and his shirt is all pressed and that he looks his best. And I thought about the school photo coming home and Curly Hall proudly putting the photograph in a frame that she placed in a prominent place. What I'm struggling with is that we know of no one today, anywhere, who has A.C. Hall's photograph on a side table, or a mantelpiece, or even in a scrapbook with all the other family photos. There's no one who breezes through a family room and sees his face looking up at them, who is reminded of him and thinks about who he was. I'll go one more step and say that there may be no one today who wakes up every year on May 7 and thinks with a smile, oh my, today's AC's birthday. And there's no one who wakes up every October 13th and thinks, oh, today is the anniversary of the day A.C. Hall was shot and killed. Maybe we will do that from now on, my students and me. Maybe we'll subconsciously imprint those dates in our minds, and they'll surface when we're least expecting them, on May 7th and October 13th. Maybe we'll be his family. And maybe you'll join us. So thank you, Newt Collier, for suggesting that A.C. Hall has a new family. Erin Aquindo had a take that I found so uplifting. We'd been focusing for weeks on the tragic death of A.C. Hall, and we'd really come to like this young man. We'd focused on the horrible circumstances that led to his death. This was some really depressing stuff. Some of us were moved to tears as we walked the night before to Ash and First Streets, where he died, and then in the morning as we stood over his gravesite. How, I wondered, do we go forward from here? How do we clear our eyes and see a path forward? As usual, a student showed the way. I'm going to let student Erin Aquindo deliver the benediction for this season of Buried Truths.
Part of me felt weird at first last night when I was at the site of his death on First Street in Ash, because I felt like I'm here because he died. But now being at the gravesite, it's like I'm here because he lived. Yeah, I'm here because he lived, and that is something that I feel like it does him a little bit of justice.
This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff.
This season of Buried Truths is produced by David Bereswain and Hank Klibanoff, with writing help from Richard Hallix, production assistance from Stephen Key and Kendall Foote, editing on this season from Marilyn Gwax and John Hawes. Christine Dempsey and J.N. Barry are executive producers, research and fact-checking by Catherine Dautrick. Special thanks to Newton Collier, Tom Duvall, Seth Stoughton, Kathy Pezdek, Rick Hutto, George Crawley, and Kitty Cosper. Thanks also to Sophia Leonard, Mary Claire Kelly, Sarah Gardner, Bibb County Sheriff David Davis, and Superior Court Clerk Erica Woodford, to J.W. August at NBC San Diego and Muriel Jackson at the Washington Memorial Library, to the Tubman Museum in Macon, to Emory University and its Centers for Digital Scholarship and Faculty Excellence, and of course to the 130 students who've taken the Civil Rights Cold Cases class at Emory. Casting by Sheila Oliver, and thanks to all our actors, Isoke Akonke, Daviar Snipes, Sarah Hallix, Robert Jones, Neil Gant, Clint Clark, Theo Harness, Travis Smith, Parker Singletary, Robbie Owenby, Freddie Ashley, and Matt Nitchie. Artwork by Shin Wuhara and Ankita Akroyd-Izales. Photography by Jonathan Kelso and Ken Krakow. Our website is wabe.org/buriedtruths. There you can make a donation to support the show, sign up for our newsletter, and download lesson plans. Follow us on social. We're at Buried Truths Podcast. And thank you for listening to Buried Truths, a production of WABE, Atlanta.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary, but when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.